Og næstur Karl M. Gjörðu svo vel.
Good evening, my name is Carl, I'm an alcoholic. But I would really, really like to thank Thor for all the work he has done to bring this about and to give me the honor of being here, and I'm sure Mickey and Michael feel the same way. This is a huge honor in my life. It's an honor to be brought with Mickey and Michael. It's an honor to be in Iceland. You know, in Los Angeles, quite often, at coffee shops, people that may talk a little bit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous may often sort of throw out, well, I got to speak at the Rodeo Drive meeting, or I got to speak at the Pacific Group, or every once in a while somebody say, well, I got to go to Texas. Well, for the next number of months, we will be able to top that story because... Because Iceland in the United States is regarded as a very exotic place. It really is. Mystical, almost. I am Icelandic by heritage, also. And in viewing out in the audience here and seeing all of the sober alcoholics, which, of course, is a small percentage of, obviously, the drinking alcoholics, I now know where my alcoholism came from. And I do have to say, this is my second time in Iceland. There is no place else other in the world that I can get off an airplane and look around and feel like I'm with my relatives. There is no place else in the world with more blonde-haired people that are not questioning why I am blonde like this. But I wouldn't want to put any kind of blame of alcoholism, because actually alcoholism has become the greatest gift in my life. It really has, and so I would want to thank Iceland for my alcoholism. And if you're new, you may not understand that, except I could maybe, hopefully, make you understand right now. If I were not alcoholic, I would not get to be standing here right now. And that is an incredible, incredible gift in my life. So I'm going to rifle right into my story. I didn't start drinking till later on in my life. I did not start drinking till I was 11 years old. Looks like that might be late in this room. I've been meeting people that are 16 years old with 4 years of sobriety here. And they have one hell of a story going on already. But I didn't know it at the time, but I believe it now. And that I believe I was an alcoholic right from the gate. And I believe this because of what happened to me within the 12 hours after taking my first drink. I was 11 years old, and my parents were out of town for the weekend, and I stole a bottle of wine from my father, and I locked myself in his study, and I proceeded to drink. And halfway through that first bottle of wine, notice I said first bottle of wine, I got this feeling that was just overwhelming. I don't even need to describe it at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys know the feeling. If I were maybe were down at I don't know what you would call your Rotary Club or your Businessman's Club, I might have to describe it further, but you guys know this feeling. I remember just halfway through that first bottle of wine taking this big, deep breath, just... Now, I didn't know that I'd been short of breath for the first 11 years of my life. I did not know that. And that's the last thing that I remember of that night, was that feeling. The next thing that I remember is that I came to in my bedroom the next morning, and there was vomit everywhere, all over the walls, all over the floor, in my pillowcase. It was in my underwear. I mean, everywhere. And I knew I was going to have to vomit again, and I made it into the bathroom. I realized I'd vomited or puked all over the bathroom floor, and I slipped on the bathroom floor, and I hit my head on the toilet bowl going down. And as I crawled back up to get my head back in the toilet bowl, I felt that wonderful, wonderful feeling that I would feel many times later in my life, and that is how nice and cold that porcelain feels on the side of your face. Love that feeling. Nothing better than being naked on a tile floor when you're drunk. And I started to heave again, and I'd made it into the dry heave stage. You know, the part where nothing's coming out but phlegm, and you're just... right? I'd made it that far, and all of a sudden my mind started to talk to me. And this is what my mind said in between dry heaves. It's going, and my mind says, this is all right, we're gonna do this again. So right there, within 12 hours of taking my first drink, everything that makes me alcoholic had happened. Halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got an abnormal, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous calls it an allergic reaction to alcohol, and the phenomenon of craving kicked in. And I lost control over the amount that I drank. I had only meant to experiment and to taste alcohol and just to see sort of what it was a little bit about and why people drank it. I had no intention of drinking two bottles of wine at 11 years old. The best way I can describe this phenomenon of craving, this bizarre reaction that my body has to alcohol, is that I seem to get thirstier the more I drink. Now, Thor was nice enough to give me this glass of water that I will probably finish most of while I'm speaking with you. However, I can promise you that after I get done speaking and finish this glass of water, I will not go out into town to buy 20 cases of water. I won't be doing that. I can absolutely guarantee you that. But if it were alcohol, I get thirstier the more I drink. But if that's all there was to being an alcoholic, was this reaction that I get when I drink, well then, one of our ex-president's wives, Nancy Reagan, when she came out and said, just say no, all of us would have gone, and we certainly would not have to have a conference like this. Maybe once a year people would band together and say, remember, just say no, and we would all go back to our lives and be successful, wouldn't we? But there's this other thing that makes me alcoholic, and this thinking. And this thinking kicked right in as I was vomiting and paying a price for my drinking the night before. Now, this thinking that I have that will take me back to the first drink at all costs, this thing they call the mental obsession, it was always able to rationalize and justify anything in my life to make it okay to drink again. Now, there at 11 years old, I'm only paying a small price for my drinking, just a little vomiting. This is no big deal. But by the time I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, my mind would be able to rationalize and justify handcuffs as being a minor and temporary inconvenience. Now, the truth about handcuffs are that they are a symbol from our society that they do not even trust us with our own hands. That's the truth about handcuffs. But I would not be able to signify that. So right there at 11 years old, I drank as often as I could, as much as I could. Well, before I started drinking, I was kind of a goofy little kid, short hair, playing violin, doing really well in school, loved my family. Once I started drinking, everything changed. Out went the violin, in came the heavy metal guitar, wanted to grow my hair down to my ass. School became a very secondary issue, and my parents became the enemy immediately. Black lights went up in my room, posters went up, my gods became Jimmy Page and Richie Blackmore, and I was back behind that locked door going, wow. And my parents were going, wow! Two very different wows to the same situation. Now, this was the summer. We lived in Seattle, Washington, in the northwestern corner of the United States at this time. And in seventh grade, a typical morning in school for me would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property. I now refer to it as Loser's Corner, where everybody hangs out and smokes, and there would always be about five or six of us that were drinking, and we would always have this jar full of the parents' liquor cabinet mixture, right? It would always be some other kid's assignment to go raid the parents' liquor cabinet and pour whatever he could into a jar and bring it to school. Now, there would be whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth, equal amounts of all of this in one jar. There'd be green things floating around in it, and you can imagine a 4 or 5, 11 and 12-year-olds handing this around and trying to choke this down. And, of course, it was the early 70s, so we were smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. Anybody remember that here in Iceland? It was even before Ziploc days when it would just be regular Glad bags. And as we'd roll that Glad bag up, there'd be about 9 people spit on it. It was We'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we're really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. And we'd hit that lighter on those seeds and stems, and the seeds and stems would be popping. We'd be burning holes in our clothes. And then we'd look at each other and go, do we go to school today? The answer was never, yes, we are late. That was never the answer. Now, it's quite often in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at this point often interrupt themselves and say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I think it's a bizarre thing for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. Now, I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and parents and things, but I don't understand apologizing to each other. In fact, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that was a few years ago. I was in a speaker meeting much like this, and the speaker was up just giving one of the ugliest, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in a speaker meeting and the drunkologue gets ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And at one point in this ugly story, this fellow said, you know, I had four DUIs. That's driving under the influence. And the judge told me that if I got one more DUI, I was going to go to prison for sure. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway, and I was drunk in a blackout, and I hit a family of four. They all wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in prison. And in prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomizing. Then he said, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. So now by the time I was 14, I was a neighborhood drunk and the neighborhood drug dealer. And I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. Yes, there was lots of whispering going on in the family. But my parents were very, very good people, and they saw that I was withering away in front of their eyes. It was no secret that all of a sudden I was, you know, before I started drinking, I had a vocabulary. School was very important. Music and sports were important. By the time I was 14, none of that was in my life anymore. And my vocabulary by this time, my hair was down in front of my eyes, and my vocabulary was, wow, whoa. Man, I would call my mother man. That's what I would do. But they always blame my problems on people, places, and things. They always thought if we can get him away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things would get better. They thought if we can get him out of that public school system into a private school, things would get better. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, places, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. All that happens if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was 17 or 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle, and my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to a university on the other side of the state, and they thought maybe this will straighten him out. Well, I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and I gained about 10 credits in 3 years. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content about a 0.25. I did nothing at that school. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore now that's why I look the way I do. Now, and I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents would not just send out Christmas cards. They would send out a big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. The first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, and the second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in marketing. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest as a marketing director. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this, and she's a very happy young woman. We're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in advertising. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou. This was a while ago, mind you. A wonderful woman named Mary Lou who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. That was like... It's about this same time that it was one more wrecked car, one more time in jail, and my parents had said, you know what, we've tried to help you again and again and again, and all you've ever done is spit in our face. If you're going to live that way, go ahead, but not around here. Just leave. And I remember packing my car up, and I was going to head south from Seattle. Now, my cars. I'd had a lot of cars ever since I'd been 16 years old, and they always started out as a perfectly good used car, but they would die of alcoholism along the way. I don't know if your cars did that or not, but mine did. And this will tell you exactly why I drank. If I were physically sober on any given morning, meaning I just haven't had a drink yet that day, and I come out of wherever I happen to be living at the time, whether it be my parents' basement or a public park, you know, depending on what part of my life we're talking about, and I come up to a car that I've owned for a while, and I haven't had a drink yet that day, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, just generally mad at the world, and I walk up to a car that I'd owned for a while, and I'd see the dents and the broken windows, and I deserve better than that. And I would get in, and I would smell the rancid smell of stale alcohol on the carpets, and I would see the cigarette and hot box burns on the seats. And then I would turn the key, and it's only hitting on one or two cylinders, and I'd be driving down the road with the rearview mirror hanging off and a cracked windshield, and I'd be driving down the road, and I'd get madder by the second, and some young guy in a nice car would blaze by and honk at me like I'm in his way, and I'd say to myself, damn it! Right? Just a little edgy here. And all I would have to do is go drink for a couple of hours. And now, after drinking for a couple of hours, I would walk up to that very same car. Now, after drinking for a couple of hours, I'd walk up to that same car, and I'd say to myself, why, that 62 Dodge Coronet is a classic. And I would get in, and it wouldn't smell bad anymore. And then the most miraculous thing I ever experienced prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous would happen when I would turn the key. Now, after drinking, I would turn that key, and as far as I was concerned, it was like, boom! It's like a mechanic had been working on my car while I'd been drinking. Now, I didn't know that the ability for alcohol to totally change my perception of my reality around me was going to actually gives me three choices: jails, insanity, death, or here. And I do have to tell you that at 11 years old, when I reacted to alcohol physically and mentally in the way that I did, my choices were jails, insanity, death, or Alcoholics Anonymous. Right now, I am 14 and a half years clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my choices have not changed. My choices are still jails, insanity, death, or Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's also why I'm so glad that Thor did the work and the other people that did a lot of the work here, because the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is very, very important. And I'm so glad that all of you have supported this, because we all know that if we don't stand together, we will die alone. We really will. And every country needs to be able to get their members of Alcoholics Anonymous need to gather on a regular basis and reconfirm that they are standing together in this disease. And so I'm very proud that you guys have done this. At that time, I headed south towards California in that car. I lived at beaches. I showered out of my car. The words are demoralizing. That's the only words to use. About a year and a half later, I was back up in the Seattle area, and a drug deal went very, very badly. And it went so badly that I joined the United States Navy. It went that badly. What I'm about to tell you should scare the daylights out of you, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAP test. It measures your potential, what you could do if you show up in the same place every day. And what I'm about to tell you should scare the daylights out of you, but this potential test qualified me to become a nuclear engineer in the Navy. That should scare the daylights out of you that the United States Navy would even think maybe, possibly, or even remotely think it's a good idea to put somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base, and I could not pass that particular test. It's called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. I could not pass that one. So I was immediately transferred out of this nuclear engineering group and kicked out of that and put into this group that they affectionately called nuclear waste, is what they called this little group of people. Now, I'll never forget the day I was in the boot camp, been there for a couple of weeks, and the list came in of all the people who had gone positive on the first year analysis who were now in jeopardy of being kicked out because they had lied about their drug use before entering the Navy. You're supposed to be kicked out. I'll never forget when what they call a master at arms, it's like a military police, would walk in with that list. And all the ones that knew our name were on the list, we knew our names were on that list, and we all kind of looked at each other, and he came in and read the names off that list, and sure enough, my name was on there. They marched us out of our boot camp company, put us in a van, and took us over to this other building on the other side of the Navy base. Then they read off everybody's name except mine, told me to sit in the van. And they marched the other men into this building, and the master-at-arms came back, and the driver drove me to another building, the building where the commanding officer of the whole base, it's called Great Lakes Naval Station, it's one of the largest naval stations in the United States, training bases, took me right into the commanding officer's office. Now, I'm getting a little worried here. Why would they be taking me here? They marched me into this big office, very plush carpeting, pictures of naval vessels all along the side, a big giant oak desk, and this man sitting behind with all this gold on, very impressive uniform. And they marched me in front of this man, and the man asks me my name. I tell him my name. And then he has a telephone on his desk, and he pushes the speakerphone button, and he says into the telephone, "Walter, it's my father's name." Now, my father, other than being the Lutheran minister, was also a Navy chaplain reservist for 40 years, ever since World War II. The man who was the commanding officer of the Great Lakes Naval Station at the time was an old war friend of my father's. And because of this sort of different spelling of my last name, it triggered a memory in him. He looked in my records, realized I was my father's son. So I'm standing there in front of him, and he says, "Walt, I have your son here. He's gone positive for the first year analysis test for cocaine. Technically, we should kick him out of the Navy. What do you think we ought to do with him? I'm calling you because you're an old friend." I hear my father's voice over the speaker say, "It is none of my concern." Click, dial tone. Now, I knew I had been embarrassing my family in the north end of Seattle for many, many years. But now I'm embarrassing my father at a national level. If I could have just slithered out of that room under that carpet, I would have. Well, they kept me in the Navy anyway, and they took away this nuclear status, and they made me what they call a conventional electrician. And for many years, they would not even let me stand watch on a light switch. 2 years later, I was a lower rank than when I first came in. This is how that would happen. See, when I was out on that ship, I would be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a big gray ship with 300 other men, all in the same uniform. It's hard to deny the fact that I was in the United States Navy. I could not deny that. However, when the ship would pull into a port, I would leave that ship, and I would take a drink, and I would totally forget that I was in the Navy. And I would come back to where I had last seen the ship when the drunk was over. And sometimes the ship would not be there. It's a very lonely feeling in a foreign country on a big, long pier looking for a big Navy ship that's not there anymore and trying to figure out what day it is. Then how am I going to explain this to my superiors? Well, after I'd been in the Navy approximately 2 years, this one morning I was already in a lot of trouble, and I was driving my car into the Navy base. And at every Navy base, there is a guard shack where a Marine will stand duty. And if you want to park your car on the base, you have to pull up to this guard shack. He will check the sticker on your car. He will check your military ID. If everything's in order, he will flag you forward, and you will be able to go onto the base. This particular morning, I guess I had a bottle between my legs. I had been drinking all weekend, and I was late. And I guess there was a depth perception problem going on. They say it was on my part. I'm not really sure about that. But all of a sudden, I could see the whites of the Marine's eyes, and I looked down at my speedometer, and I was going 35 or 40 miles an hour, approximately 50 kilometers per hour, and I tried to swerve the car, and the car hit this median on the right-hand side. It flipped up on its side and went right through the guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. Now, the most significant thing that happened that morning is that they put the Navy doctors, after patching me up, the Marine was okay. He survived this. I survived it. The most significant thing is that the Navy doctors put me on medical science's best shot at the alcoholic. It's called Anabuse. They prescribed this Anabuse for me. The doctors gave me a little warning about drinking on top of Anabuse. I filed that information for future reference. They sent this prescription for antabuse back to the ship's doctor, and every morning I would have to show up at the sick bay, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour. Over the next few days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this disease called alcoholism, and that is that I had developed a spiritual malady which made it impossible for me not to drink. I remember counting those days on that antabuse, just... It's been about 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on antabuse. I started to look around that ship, and the other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Do you ever feel that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. But I'm sure only with love and tolerance in Iceland, you know. On about the 10th day on this antabuse, I snapped. And I went AWOL from my ship. I left the ship without authorization simply because my division officer had asked me to do a very legitimate task, and I could not believe that he had asked me to do this lowly task. So I let the division officer know how I felt. Military officers are very concerned with their subordinates' feelings. So I said to him, "You obviously don't know who I am, do you?" And I'll never forget this. He turned on his heels and he stared me down and he said, "All right, who are you?" And I stood there like... To this day that I stand before you, that's the most embarrassing question I had ever been asked in my life. So I left the ship, and I went down to downtown San Diego where the ship was in dock there, and I checked into this little flea bag hotel called the Plaza Hotel. I got a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I sat in this little hotel on the edge of the bed with this little nightstand and the bottle of vodka and the shot glass in front of me, and I remembered the warning that the Navy doctors had given me about drinking on top of antabuse. They had said, "Son, if you drink on top of antabuse, you'll get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die." I remember thinking, "Well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get." And I took one shot, and nothing happened. I figured authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. I looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and then all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. I have to tell you, this is a very sick group if you think that's funny. Non-alcoholics do not find this to be humorous. In fact, I have proof of that. About 12 years ago, when I was about 2 years sober and I got out of the Navy, one of the amends that I had to make is I owed my parents either the money back for the bachelor's degree they had paid for, or I had to go get what they paid for on my own. I had chosen to do the second one, to go get the bachelor's degree that they had paid for as part of my amends. And so I got out of the Navy and I signed up for school when I was about 2 years sober. And in order to get some of the basic credits out of the way, I took a speech class. And in the beginning of this speech class, in the first few days, the instructor just randomly pointed at some of the students and threw them up in front of the group, set a topic, and just to see how they did, so he could get a feel for how the classroom was. Well, after about 5 or 6 of the students, he pointed at me, got me up there, and from the corner of the classroom, the instructor said, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So So I told him about drinking on top of anabuse. They did not react the way you did. They were like... It took me months to get any friends in that class after that. So I'm back in the hotel room, hyperventilating, sweating, puke. I take another shot. And up it came, my late sponsor, Eddie C. I miss that man. He just died 2.5 years ago, and I miss him very much. But he used to say that this next thing that happened to me, he would call projectile regurgitation. Just up and out. Just, thank God this hotel room I was in had the toilet in the same room as the bed. Now, this type of vomiting and throwing up was different than what I was used to, because one of the tools for living that I had gotten out there is what I call socially throwing up. That's where you can have a little good buzz on going, and you can be anywhere. I mean, you can be at a party, you can be in a park, you can be driving, you can be in front of your grandmother, and you get that little warning. Little sour taste in the back of your throat, maybe a little bit comes up. That's the alcoholic warning that you have anywhere from 10 seconds to 2 minutes to find a place to puke. Now, you know, if there's a bathroom handy, we of course use that. If we're driving, we just attempt to get the window down. If there's no other place, a friend's shoe might be the right place. You know, just whatever. But here on this anabuse, there was no warning. It's just, just... But I found the magic of drinking on top of anabuse. That if you don't die, remember that, if you don't die and you hang in there, that's the secret. You got to hang in there and not die. Got to get those two things going at the same time. It's a little bit of a juggling act, but I found that if I hung in there after and I would drink and I would puke and I would drink and I would puke for somewhere between 1 to 2 hours, and enough of the anabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up. And then I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating, and sweating. And I already told you, I'm all right with that. It's all right. I drank on top of anabuse for approximately 7 months. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot after I was wandering around drunk out of my mind. Apparently, I was looking for some crack cocaine. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And three men jumped me for my money and my military ID. And the next thing I knew, I had woken up, I came to, and there was, and we all know this, there are always signs that we look for as to whether things are all right or things are not, right? One of the things that would always signal to me that things were not all right is when there were always these bright lights, these surgical lights shining down on you, and men and women with masks and tools in their hands. This was always a sign that things had gone badly the night before. And this is the way I came to that morning, and they were doing reconstructive surgery on my face. They had to reset my jaw, wire it shut, 26 stitches in my face. And they had to do some minor plastic surgery after that. I'm very grateful that they actually were able to get my face back in order. I remember after I had been in the hospital and my face was my jaw was still wired shut, I was in the hospital and fully medically detoxed. Now, this is an example of my alcoholic mind, not my alcoholic body, because I had been detoxed with IVs and everything that that hospital had to offer, and it was a good 5 to 7 days later that I was being led down the steps of the hospital with my jaw wired shut, crouched over like I was about 90 years old, being helped down some stairs. And this is what my mind said to me as I was being helped down those stairs. I said to the man from my ship that was helping me down those stairs, I said, if there's any time I need a drink, it's now. But now this man was a good Navy man and he agreed with me. Got me a bottle of vodka and a straw. That's what I needed. My last drunk, a few months later, I was left, I was coming out of the San Diego jail in handcuffs, being brought back to the ship, and the orders had already been processed on the ship the night before, and the orders on the ship had said, we will not accept him back on this ship. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or, and I remember as I was standing there in handcuffs, it was one of those days where the neck muscles weren't working quite right and the handcuffs, and I hated those mornings when you're in handcuffs and you can't quite think straight, and there's all these authoritative type people making decisions about what to do with you. Just hated those mornings. I've often looked back and wondered what would have happened if I could have gotten my neck muscles to work and pop up and say, would you like my opinion? After they read the part of 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, the officer of the deck then read this part, and he got this disgusted look on his face as he read this, like he couldn't believe the words he was reading. He said, 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or apparently, according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, we have to offer this man treatment first before he gets discharged. Now, that changed a few years later, but the decision was not made for me at that. I was not standing there in handcuffs saying, this is a good day to get sober. Oh, I see my life is really at its end and that I now need to get sober. The decision was made for me. I was turned around and thrown back in the shore patrol van, the military police, and taken up to a treatment center. And until the doors were locked behind me, the handcuffs were not taken off. And I showed up at this treatment center. And everybody that showed up at this treatment center in the same week, we were all going to do this 45-day thing together. And we were in this sort of group therapy type setting. And on about the second or third day, this one man from another base raises his hand to talk. Nobody's talking. Everybody's just looking at the floor. I don't remember anybody being that happy to be there. And this one fellow raises his hand and says, I hear that if I'm going to stay sober, I need to be rigorously honest with you. And now his name was Paco. I had never met him before. And he said, I need to be rigorously honest with you. Paco is not my real name. Paco's just a street name I've had ever since I've been a young boy. And my real name is Randy. I want to be honest with you guys. My name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on? Well, none of us were that impressed with it. And we just sort of looked up from the floor enough time to say, great, nice to meet you, Randy. And looked back down at the floor. But apparently the facilitators of this place got very excited about Randy's honesty. Later that afternoon, they paraded Randy right in front of the rest of us. They slapped a gold name tag on him that said Randy. And then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. We loved him. Oh, we just loved him. On about the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had no prior opinion as to what Alcoholics Anonymous was or was not. All I know is that they read off a bunch of names and told us which van to get into, and they drove us out into town, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting in a room much like this, and they start doing some reading. And then people get up and share for 3 to 5 minutes each. Now, I didn't know that it was a participation meeting, didn't know that there were different types of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there were speaker meetings or step study workshops or regular participation meetings. I didn't know any of that. All I know is that in a blur, I sat in the back, and I heard them do some reading, and then it probably 10 to 12 people got up and talked for a few minutes each. And all I know is that as I sat there and listened to them read, and when they shared, that I got this feeling in my gut of, oh my God, they know. They know. Now, I'm not sure what it is that they know that I think I know, but they know. Now, I'll never forget this one fellow who got called on, and he walked all the way to the front. There's a podium participation meeting. And he introduced himself, and he said one sentence, and he sat down. And he described the alcoholic mind better than I've ever heard it described. He walked up, and he said, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. And he sat down. And I was just, whoa. Now, one of the main things that was going on there is that somebody brand new with no prior experience of Alcoholics Anonymous was getting the basic message of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they drank like me and they thank like me, right? Just in the little things that they were saying. Because, you know, I had, for years, in the last 5 to 8 years of my drinking, I had a lot of dirty little secrets. We all have those dirty, ugly things from our past that we're not going to tell anybody. You know that thing that happened in the middle of that night that Even if you just witnessed it, maybe not even a part of it, you know you were fundamentally changed as a human being. That thing that if you knew that your grandmother had ever seen you involved with, you couldn't live with yourself. Those things that happen again and again in the alcoholic life. We all have that. But there was something else that had been just killing me on the inside. And that is that I could not explain to myself or anybody else why I drank the way I did. I mean, through my life, there had been very ugly scenes as a result of my drinking. And I remember feeling like as some sort of authority or a parent or a girlfriend or somebody would be yelling at me about my drinking, I would be responding with, yes, yes, I know. I know. Yes, yes, yes. I see that my drinking is out of hand. Yes, I see that burning car over there. I understand. I know it looks like my drinking is out of hand. I know it looks like what. But deep down inside, if I could have somehow worded it, I would have said to them, but if you knew how I felt when I was not drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. And that was something that I could never have verbalized, but was killing me on the inside. And yet at that very first meeting, I heard people mentioning just that. What happens to us when we take the alcohol and or drugs away from us? This strange mental obsession and this spiritual malady, this inability to function on this planet without returning to the drink. And that's the perplexing part of this disease called alcoholism, this part that we can't even explain to ourselves. And I certainly did not fully understand it that first night, nor for a long time. But I got a little glimmer of hope that these people understood that. Now, the next night, I went to another meeting, and I got very confused at this meeting because everybody was talking about something called a drug of choice. One person would get up and say, well, my drug of choice is. And somebody else would say, well, my drug of choice is. And I was sitting there in the back going, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What do they want me to do? So I'm back at this treatment center, and I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us. Her name was Mary Weber, wonderful woman, a non-alcoholic, very devoted to working with alcoholics. And I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that? Now, I'm like 8 days into this thing. I'm still very foggy. And she says, let's play a game. Okay. She said, let's imagine that I walked into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels and an ounce of cocaine and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Ha, 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 ha. And I said, I'd take them all. And she started to snap her fingers. Settle down, settle down. Come on back. And my eyes refocused for a minute. And she said, you can only have one. Which one would you take? I said, well, I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I'd take the ounce of cocaine. And she said, well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? I said, no, no, I don't understand. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, if I can only have one of them, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine, I'd get the hell out of here, and I'd sell half of it. Now I'd have enough money to buy a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do. Now, the only reason that I bring that up is that if you work with lots of new people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you would know this, that many people think that there's, depending on their drug of choice or what they think when they're brand new, what they think their drug of choice might be, that they are going to have multiple sobriety dates. If you work with lots of new people, you may run across this type of scenario like I do. Every once in a while, I'll see a new fellow around my group, seen him for a little bit, and I'll say, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And the answer might be, well, my drinking sobriety date is January 3rd. My pot clean date was May 8th. And I blew my methamphetamine, my speed date, last night. I was wandering the streets all night. Saying that it's one sobriety day. Every once in a while, this one time, the funniest thing I've ever heard about sobriety dates was, same scenario, saw this guy around my home group for a while. I went up to him and I said, hey, good to see you. How long do you have? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night. So now I have 89 days. I had to think about that one for a second. I think that kind of falls into the same category as being out of your country, maybe down in Mexico or something, looking at the tequila going, Would that affect my U.S. or my Icelandic sobriety date? Yes, sobriety dates are international. Anyway, after 45 days in this treatment center, they're going to let us all out. They gathered all 35 of us that were going to be let out on a Wednesday. They're going to let us out on a Friday. They put us all in this room. And the biggest, meanest counselor from the place came in, and he was a Marine. And he came in his full dress uniform. And it's a very impressive, intimidating sight. And all of us knew that we were going to get out in 2 days. And we kind of like, as he walked in, he just grabbed, there was a podium up front, and he grabbed both sides. And us 35 were sitting out there, and he stared us all down. And it seemed like an eternity before he spoke. He just stared every one of us in the eyes. And then he spoke. And we're all like, he said, "This treatment center has been here for many, many years. This is one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. And over the years, our statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to our statistics, out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward." If you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could hear a pin drop now. The only thing you could hear was me going, "Shit." Because I knew that if only one of us was going to make it, it wasn't going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It was going to be Randy over here. By now, he's the poster boy of the treatment center. So on this Friday, they're letting us all out. Some people were picked up by their base or their ship, and some of us who had been arrested out in town the night before and our cars had been put into an impound lot had to wait on the front doorsteps of this treatment center, waiting for our cars to be brought out of impound. And we were standing there, about five or six of us, and one of the guys points to this car that's slowly coming towards us from the other end of the parking lot, and he points and he says, "Is that Randy driving that car?" And we look a little closer. Yeah, that seems to be Randy. Maybe he got out a little bit early for turning in that gold name tag or something. Who knows? As the car got a little bit closer, one of the other fellows says, "He's drinking already." And sure enough, he's just polishing off a pint right there, driving right in front of the treatment center. He rolls down the window as he drives by us. He throws the empty pint right at our feet. Crash! We look up. And we look up. He's giving us all the finger, and he's driving right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. The next thing that I remember of that night is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called the 6 o'clock gong show meeting. They have four people sitting up front and a big gong and a mallet and a podium. And they let anybody get up that wants to get up. However, if these four people decide the person is carrying on too long or sniveling or not talking about the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, they start whispering amongst themselves. If the person is still so self-obsessed that he doesn't notice them whispering right here, they pull out the mallet. And the crowd starts to go crazy, and they go bong. And, of course, the person, I never raised my hand at that meeting ever. I'm sitting in the back that night. I'm 45 days without a drink or a drug, fresh out of the treatment center, no more than 6 hours out of that treatment center. If there's ever a turning point in my life, it was right there then at that meeting. I'm sitting in the back. Truth about my life is I've got 45 days. I've got a lot of information about alcoholism. I'm in the best physical condition I've been in since I've been a young boy because I've been eating right and a lot of physical exercise. So I've got those three things going. I've got information, physically in better shape, and I've got 45 days. There had been no spiritual awakening or a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. It hadn't happened. I had information in 45 days. I was primed for a good long drunk is what I was primed for. But I wouldn't have known that at that time. I had this strange feeling sitting in the back. Well, I've just been through 45 days of treatment, and I don't feel very treated. As the hours ticked by, I got more insane. And I was sitting in the back there, and all I ever wore whenever I left the Navy base were black leather pants, black leather jacket, black tank top. I would stop by a gas station with one of these wall blow dryers, put a bunch of gel in my hair and make it stand straight up. And I wore long, dangly earrings and sunglasses at night. My friend Mickey says at that point in my life, I was suffering from what he calls IRS problems. That's imaginary rock star is what that is. One guy that night sitting in the back operating on his primary purpose that night leaned over to me and said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? I didn't think quick enough to lie to him because I would have. If I just would have thought for 1 second, I would have made up a story. But I didn't think quick enough, so I told him the truth. I said, you know, I just got out of this Navy treatment center and, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. This man's eyes went bing, big smile went across. He looked like he had just landed a giant marlin. I didn't know there were men in Alcoholics Anonymous that would lurk around the backs of meetings looking for other men that didn't know what they were doing. And that it's sort of like a prize when you find one that admits they don't know what they're doing. I didn't know that most new people say, I know what I'm doing, don't bother me, I'm fine. Right? And he was like keeping me away from his friends. He was like, I was his. Now, I now know why he was especially glad to meet me that night, other than just the fact that he was that type of a fellow in Alcoholics Anonymous. This man's girlfriend had left him the night before for another friend of his in his home group. So he was wondering what to do with his weekend. Homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that weekend. And this guy was just crazy over this woman all weekend. After each meeting, he'd throw me into the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting. He'd be yelling at me, going, you gotta go to meetings, you gotta get a sponsor, you gotta read the book, damn her. Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, damn her. I'm going. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that this man, that night, in the back of that meeting, was somebody who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous and understood through doing the work of Alcoholics Anonymous that the solution to his pain that night was out of self, out of self, out of self. I'm so very glad that that particular man, that night, was not at home underneath his covers, whining into his sponsor's answering machine. She left, she left, she left. Instead, he was out there dragging my sorry butt around to meetings. And I learned something very, very valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, and certainly all through our lives. How many people know a little bit about American football, not soccer? Nobody. Well, on American football, the whole team will gather in between each play, about every minute or so. They'll only do one play. They'll gather up, and they'll huddle up together, and they'll make a plan for the next play that they do in the sport. And what I'm going to correlate how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to how they huddle up in a football game. See, they'll only do one play at a time in football, and they'll huddle up, they'll make a new plan, and they'll do one play. Then they'll huddle up again, and they'll do just one more play. And the purpose, of course, is to win the game. And it's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to win the game in Alcoholics Anonymous is one day without a drink or a drug, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day here? We run in here, and we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily, mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there, and we try a little of this. We try a little bit of that. And we run right back in here, and we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily, mentally different from our fellows. And just before we break, some fellow in the corner might go, wait, 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 wait. I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broke and I'm bored. What do I do? Some old-timer will stand up, look over his glasses, and say, get a job. Break. And we go out there and we try a little of this, try a little of that. And I always have to remember that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows in regards to alcohol. My brother and I look a lot alike. And that's sort of abnormal over there. I see a lot of people that look like my brother here right now. But that's very abnormal. Iceland's the only place that I can see that. But my brother and I, now that I'm sober, have many of the same views politically. We enjoy a lot of the same things. We're related by blood. We're very much alike, except in our relationship to alcohol. He does strange things, like when we're out golfing, on the third or fourth hole, the woman will come by with the drink cart and he'll order a beer. And he'll forget that it's there. He'll open it, he'll have a couple of sips, and then I'll have to remind him about 20 minutes. You've got your beer there! He has a very bizarre relationship to alcohol. But I have to remember that even though I may be very similar to him in many ways, I must remember that I'm bodily and mentally different in regards to alcohol. Here's another example. At the same time as I came here to Iceland for 12 days last year in July. And then my mother and I went to meet my brother and his wife in France. And they were staying at they had rented a nice house out in the wine country area, which is basically all of France, but outside Avignon. And they took us all out to one of those like 15-course French dinners in the countryside, right? And of course, everybody else drank, and they were, of course, at those things they have you sample all of the wines of the region. I was, of course, sampling all of the Diet Cokes of the region and the different waters they had of the region. And this is an example of exactly how I truly feel the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. After a few different glasses of wine, which they only gave about that much, my mother, when the third one came around, she said, "No, no more for me." And I just sort of let it go. And afterwards, I said, "Mom, we were in the south of France, in wine country. Why didn't you try a little bit more? You know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience." She said, "Well, I started to feel it." Now, this is strange. But that's not the strange part. I asked her, "What did you start to feel?" And she said, "I started to feel a little bit out of control, and I don't like that feeling. And when I feel that, I will stop." Now, that is a fundamentally different relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she was saying is that in her normal life, she feels at peace and in control of her surroundings. And she drinks a little bit of alcohol, and she begins to feel out of control, and she doesn't like that feeling. That's exactly the opposite from me, because of and by myself, with no alcohol, I do not feel at peace. I feel restless, irritable, and discontent, and completely out of control. And you give me a few drinks of alcohol, and I begin to feel in control. It is a totally, fundamentally different relationship to alcohol. And I've got to remember, I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows in regards to alcohol. At the same time, I've got to remember that if I'm alcoholic, I'm bodily and mentally similar to you. And we can have a world of differences in the other areas of our lives, even in our stories. So if you sat there and were listening to my story and been saying, "Well, I'm not American. I was never in the Navy. I didn't use any drugs. Certainly did not have a Lutheran minister for a father." Even though I hear that's kind of common around here too. You're listening to the wrong things. Because if we listen to people's story in Alcoholics Anonymous based upon facts and circumstances, we're going to miss the boat. We need to listen to what happens to us when we do drink and what happens to us when we try not to drink. And that's the common thread that we can all grab a hold of. So I get out after that weekend of 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get back to my ship, and the one other recovering alcoholic is on that ship. His name was Bob W., and he seeks me out, and he gets all excited. He's just another guy like this front guy from the weekend, and he starts dragging me to meetings. We're going to lots and lots of meetings, and then the ship had to go out to sea a few months later. For the very first time, I was going to have to go out to sea on the ship sober. And he told me I needed to meet him in the aft end of the ship every night at 6:30. And the first night at 6:30, I was waiting there for him. And he walked in with that blue book, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he tossed it down on the table and he said, "We've been to lots of meetings together. Have you read it?" And I sort of stuttered and stammered. And I said, "Well, yeah, there's like how it works. There's we antagonists. There's some doctor with some opinion about something. And so while the ship was out at sea for 21 days, we started right at the beginning of the book. He started to read. When he got tired, he had me read. And we did a very unique thing these days in Alcoholics Anonymous. When the book told us to do something, we set the book down and did it before we continued on. And by doing that in that 21 days, he tricked me into working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we came back from that 21 days out at sea, and I had this list that I was not happy with. But he seemed to be ecstatic about it. I am so very grateful that Bob, my first sponsor when I was in the Navy, when I got to that ship, was a type of man in Alcoholics Anonymous that was doing the deal around here. He had a sponsor. He had commitments. He was going to lots and lots of meetings. I'm very grateful that the one other recovering alcoholic on that ship was not somebody who, when posed with the question that there's a brand new person out of a treatment center, would have to think to himself, boy, I haven't been to a meeting in about 6 months. I wonder where they are now. He was living a way of life that all he had to do was stick his hand out and say, do what I'm doing, and he could save my life. Just by saying, come on and do it with me, right? And then take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That 21 days when he took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning I was taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not get what I believe is promised by Alcoholics Anonymous when they talk about spiritual awakening and spiritual experience. Sounds strange. I believe I received, when I took the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous this first time, that I got a personality change, like it talks about in the spiritual experience in the appendices of the Big Book, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I did not get what is promised in Alcoholics Anonymous when they talk about the spiritual awakening, this drastic rearrangement of ideas, until I started to do for others what had been done for me. That's when it really happened. That's when I started to feel meaning and purpose in my life for the very first time. The only time I had ever felt meaning and purpose in my life before was somewhere between the 8th and 10th drink. And I'd better find that in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I don't believe I can stay. Now, I also found early on in sobriety what it means and how so valuable it is for one alcoholic to work with another alcoholic, that the alcoholic can affect the other alcoholic like no one else can. Our ship was in Victoria, B.C. in Canada, and like normal, my first sponsor and I, Bob, would run out to go to meetings in town. And after the meetings, we quite often would rent a little hotel room to be able to sleep the night off the ship if we were allowed to that night. This particular night, after the meetings in town, I went out with the AAers. He said he was a little tired. He went back to the hotel room that we had gotten. And a few hours later, I get back to the hotel room. And Bob is there with this other man from our ship who is just drunk out of his mind. He's falling out of the chair. And he's just obviously in a blackout. But Bob is there with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous reading to him. Now, I look at this scene and I think, now, Bob is really desperate to stay sober tonight. He's reading to a guy that will never remember anything. So I just sort of went over to my end of the bedroom and turned my light out, and went to sleep. About a week and a half later, I'm on the ship. The ship is back in San Diego. And there's this knocking on my bunk. And it's Bob. He's going, Carl, wake up. It's 3 a.m. And I go, Bob, what? He goes, Blair, this other man that he'd been talking to in Canada, Blair is up on the Coronado Bridge. It's a giant bridge in San Diego, very popular for suicide. In fact, so popular for suicide that they have a telephone at the top of the bridge for the suicide hotline in case you change your mind. Well, apparently Blair had climbed up there, said this not drinking thing or trying not to drink was too much for him, and he was going to jump off the Coronado Bridge. But he had a second thought, and he'd gotten onto the telephone up there at the top of this bridge, and he'd called the suicide hotline. And apparently he had told the suicide hotline, I will only talk to Bob W. Now the woman on the other end of the line said, who's Bob W? And he said, it's anonymous. But I'll only talk to Bob W. Well, somehow they dragged out of Blair what ship he was from, that he was in the Navy and what ship, So they immediately called down to the deck, the quarter deck of our ship, and they said, "Is there a Bob W. there?" Now, in saying that, because my first sponsor did not guard his own anonymity on that ship. Oh, he would guard yours with his life. But he did not guard his own on that ship simply for so that he could be of service whenever the need arose. And this night, it was just one of those nights. They called down, and "Is there a Bob W. there?" And, of course, the officer of the deck said, "Oh, yes, Mr. 12-step, yes, yes, yes." They went down and woke up Bob, and then Bob comes down to me at 3 in the morning. "Come on, we're going." So we get into his car, and we're driving down to the Coronado Bridge. And Bob says, "Grab the big book out of the glove box. Let's read up on working with others." So I open it up, and I start reading, and it says, "See your man alone if possible." Well, sure enough, he's alone up there, isn't he? "Place this book where he may run across." Oh, well, it'll fall in the water. And he just, "Oh, forget it. We're going to wing it." So we get down to this scene at the Coronado Bridge, and everything that the county and the state has available for a situation like this is there at the base of this bridge. Fire trucks, paramedics, counselors, a psychiatrist, the fire chief, they're all there. And they don't know what to do with this guy up on the bridge. The fire chief sees us two walking up and says, "Is one of you Bob W?" And Bob goes, "Yeah, that's me." He goes, "We've been trying for 2 hours. Go ahead," hands him the microphone. And Bob goes, "Blair," and you can hear over the speaker, "Bob, is that you?" And Bob says, "Yes, Blair, it's me, Bob. Now get the hell down from that bridge." And you can hear, "Okay." One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like nobody else can. When I was 2 years sober, I got out of the Navy. I packed everything I owned into the car that I got sober with because I was having to make financial amends. I could not buy anything. The car I got sober with was a 1968 Volkswagen with a hole in the floorboard that I had to push start. It was only hitting on a couple of cylinders. And I'm 2 years sober, out of the Navy, moving up to Los Angeles to go to school. And I'm puttering along the highway and I'm thinking, I need to get a job. I have to go to school. Well, I'll stop by some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when it's convenient. And I accidentally pulled into this little town in Los Angeles called Covina, and I went to a noon meeting. I just wanted to see where the meetings were, for when I needed one, I could go there. Now, this is very smart thinking for an alcoholic of my type. And I went into that meeting, and I met this man named Eddie Cochran, who just passed away in March 14th of 1998, and he became my sponsor for the next 10 years. This man changed the course of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 10 years sober when I was born. When I met him, he had 35 years. And when I met him, he poured me a cup of coffee and started chatting with me. He had never seen me around the group before. And I tried to explain to him, "Well, you know, Eddie, I just got out of the Navy. I need to get a job, and I need to go to school, and I'll stop by. I'm glad to find out where the meetings are here in this town, because I'll come by when I get a chance." And he just started to chuckle like he always would. He just always had this funny little laugh. I'm sure Michael remembers him, and Mickey, of course, knows him. And he had this funny little laugh, and he said, "Oh, yes, school and work. Those are wonderful things for a young man recovering from alcoholism. But that's what we do in between meetings." He was giving me one of the most fundamental secrets to being able to stay sane and sober and to get the life that we're promised here in Alcoholics Anonymous on the long term. What he was teaching me was that I needed to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. So many of my friends and so many people I have known have tried to live out in the world and visit Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient, and they're not here. Now, when I say live in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not saying that you need to go to the sunrise meeting, the noon meeting, the 8 o'clock meeting, and the midnight meeting and get a job down at the local New Alano Club serving coffee. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a spiritual centeredness of knowing who and what I am, what my problem is, what my solution is, and what the plan of action I need to activate in my life on a regular basis is. I need to have that first in my life. And one of the very first things he told me I needed to do was put newcomers in my car and take them to meetings. And I said, "But Eddie, I have to push start the car. There's a hole in the floorboard. One of them might fall out." He said, put newcomers in your car and your life will get better. Now, I didn't see how this could possibly be. But since he was 10 years sober when I was born, I thought I might give it a try. And the very first night I did it, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car for me. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. Now, I'm going to be able to sum this up right now with one little story, and this will tell you exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. About a year ago, I was asked to come down to a little campout conference in Nogales, Arizona. I get asked a little bit, certainly not as much as Mickey and Michael do. They travel all over the place. I get a chance to do it maybe 10, 15 times a year to go out of state. And I got called to go to Nogales, Arizona. And I knew that it was going to be one of these things where it's a camp out, and that when I showed up, they were going to show me my little tent where the trucks are driving by, and they were going to, I was going to have to knock on somebody's trailer door to go to the bathroom. But I had committed to doing that, and so I was about ready to leave for this area called Nogales, Arizona. It was a long trip. And so I called my mother before I left town, like I do. I carry a pager that is good. I can be paged anywhere in the whole continental United States. And I told her, you know what? There might be a blanked out area because this Nogales, Arizona is such a remote area. You may not be able to get a hold of me. I've always wanted my mother to know how to get a hold of me at any time. She's 73 years old now. And so she said, Nogales, Arizona. Our old friends Don and Leona live just about 40 miles north of that. Give them a call. Maybe you can get with them over the weekend. And I had to say, Mom, you have to remind me, who's Don and Leona? And she described, remember Don and Leona, lifelong friends. Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding, and we've stayed very good friends over the years. And I said, oh, great. So I call up Don, and I say, I'm coming to your area of the country here this weekend. I'd like to get together. And he says, do you like to golf? Now, that's a big trigger for me. I'm like, oh, yes. It's one of my favorite things behind Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of my favorite things. So he said, bring your golf clubs, we'll go out golfing. And so I met with him on the Saturday afternoon in the middle of this convention, went up and met with him, and went out to his golf club, and we started golfing. And right off the bat at the first hole, he started asking very specific, pertinent questions about my life. He knew all about my life. As he was going, he knew what school, when I got out of the Navy, he knew what school I had graduated from, with what type of degree. He knew what companies I had been with. He knew about the recovery homes I'm with, and the nonprofit foundation I'm with, and the work I do with the court system now. He knew all about my life, and he was asking all these pertinent questions. And by the fourth hole of golf, I had to stop him and say, Don, I'm very confused. How on earth do you know all of this about my life right now? And I barely, I haven't seen you since I was a young boy. And he said, well, two things. The first thing is that before your father died, I would talk to him many times, and he was just so proud of what you were doing in your life that he was always talking about what you were doing in your life. Now, that was nice to hear from somebody else, but my father had never hidden that from me when I was sober before he died. He had often expressed that. There had never been a problem there. But it was nice to hear from an old friend of his that my father, and a reminder that my father had been very proud of me. That was very important. But the next thing he said summed it all up for me. He said, and besides, every Christmas, I get the letter. It's like, yes, I'm finally in there. Good night. Have a great weekend.